Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Fulton Lewis, Jr., speaking from the banquet hall of the Hotel Roanoke to the facilities of station WSLS in Roanoke, Virginia. First of all, the Navy issued a communique with a bit of good news about the warfare in the Pacific this evening. It says that American submarines continuing their attack on Japanese surface vessels in Far Eastern waters definitely have sunk four more of those vessels and have damaged another four. The ones that were sunk were two large freighters, one medium freighter, and one patrol boat. The ones that were damaged were a large tanker that was left burning furiously, a large freighter, and a large transport ship, and one medium-sized freighter. That brings to a total of 107 the number of Japanese ships that have been sunk and probably sunk or seriously damaged by American submarines in the far Pacific since we entered the war on December the 7th. And that figure includes only the ships that have been sunk by submarines, not those that have been sunk by airplane bombing nor surface action by the American fleet. That scrap iron that we sent over to Japan isn't going to hold out forever at that rate. The reports from Madagascar say that the French governor of that island colony has turned down the terms of armistice which the British invading forces offered in reply to his request for an armistice yesterday. That was dictated to the French governor of Madagascar by the Vichy government at home. And it's just as well, because there appears to be no doubt that the British are going to be able to capture that whole island with comparative ease. And when you capture it with no strings attached. When there's an armistice, there usually are some kinds of strings or qualifications. As a matter of fact, the reports in diplomatic circles in Washington tonight are that the British forces on Madagascar demanded total and complete surrender as the terms of the armistice, because they felt that they didn't have to grant any concessions, they didn't intend to make any. Here on the home front, the office of the oil coordinator, Mr. Ickes, officially announced today that the agreement about which I told you last evening, the agreement between the oil companies of the nation voluntarily to pool their pipelines and their tank facilities and their tank cars and everything else, and to give up trade name brands of gasoline in order to make the most effective possible use of all those facilities, thereby help to solve the gasoline and fuel shortages in eastern and northeastern states for this winter. It was explained by Mr. Ickes that individual brands of gasoline no longer will be kept separate, each with its own identity, but that instead all brands will be pooled together in whatever pipeline and tank facilities may be available. Wherever you buy your gasoline, after this goes into effect, you'll get essentially the same gasoline, just general gasoline. But the fact that the brands no longer will be kept separate will release a lot of storage and tank car capacity that will make it possible for a much greater total of gasoline and fuel oil to be delivered to those parts of the country that now are short. Mr. Ickes did make it clear that no one is guaranteeing that this will completely cure the gasoline and fuel oil problem for those parts of the country, but it certainly will be a major help in that direction. Mr. Donald Nelson, head of the War Production Board, told the Committee of Congress today that the war production program now is beginning to reach the maximum production rate in all sorts of fighting equipment. From here on out, the great problem is to coordinate properly the flow of raw materials, the steel and copper and such things, into an even flow so that everything will be where it's needed when it is needed. He was asked whether he believes it will be necessary to put into effect the Universal Manpower Conscription Program, which Mr. Paul McNutt, the head of the Manpower Commission, proposed before this same committee yesterday, the program by which all workers would be drafted into under government control and sent to work in such places and such factories in those places as the government sees fit. He rather dodged any specific answer on the program as such. He said that he had not seen the program, therefore has not had any opportunity to study it, but that just as a general principle, war workers must obviously be had where they are needed. He left a rather definite impression, however, that he's not sure that the manpower problem requires anything quite so drastic just at the present moment as the program which Mr. McNutt laid down yesterday. In the meantime, speaking of the manpower problem, you remember I told you last Friday night that a special fact-finding subcommittee panel, as they call it, of the War Labor Board was considering a case involving the wages of copper miners in the West, which was likely to cause something of an explosion. It's the old story of those copper miners who have been leaving their jobs to go to the better-paying positions in shipyards and aircraft factories, I reported to you that that fact-finding committee of the War Labor Board was getting ready to recommend a sizable wage increase for the copper miners in order to eliminate that lure of better wages in other fields. I also told you that there was a very heated difference of opinion on the matter within the fact-finding committee and that a minority report recommending against the wage increase would be filed with the majority report. The two of them have been made public. The majority report recommends varying wage increases of from 2.5 to 15 cents an hour, according to the job, all of which may be very well deserved. However, the War Labor Board has established a wage policy, as you know, that policy being that workers are entitled to a wage increase since January the 1st, 1941, sufficient to meet the 15% increase in the cost of living since that time. But if they already have received that much of a wage increase, they are not entitled to any more. In this case, the minority report on this copper incident reports or points out that these copper miners already have received a 40% wage increase since January 1st, 1941, and this new wage increase that's recommended would be on top of that 40%. The argument in the minority report is that that is a violation by the War Labor Board of the Board's own formula, for which it has been asking public support and labor support and industrial support. What's more, it actually puts the government in the business of wage competition between industries, which is what most of the government in Washington is trying hard to stop. What's more, Mr. McNutt already has frozen all those copper workers on the job. They are not permitted to shift to any better paying jobs in other lines, even if they wanted to. The whole thing now, however, is up to the War Labor Board as a whole, this being merely a report of a fact-finding committee, and it's a fair guess that the War Labor Board wishes that it was not up to them. Now, getting back to Mr. Nelson, I learned tonight that he will announce tomorrow the final decision on the case of Mr. Henry J. Kaiser of California and those supercargo planes which Mr. Kaiser has been trying to get permission to build. Now, there was some talk that the decision officially might be handed down this afternoon, but the latest information is that a couple of final last-minute details had to be worked out, so it was put off until tomorrow. Mr. Elmer Davis, my former colleague in the radio news world, now head of the Office of War Information in Washington, appeared before a special Senate committee today and said that the recent order by Mr. James Petrillo, the head of the American Federation of Musicians Union, the order forbidding union musicians from making phonograph records that would be played by radio stations or by any public reproducing system, such as nickel and the slot machines, he said it's a serious blow to national morale. This special committee is holding preliminary hearings to decide whether a formal investigation of Mr. Petrillo and his order should be undertaken. It's headed by Senator D. Worth Clark of Idaho, a Democrat, and Mr. Elmer Davis was the first witness. Mr. Davis said that the radio stations of the nation are vitally essential to the proper informing of the American public, particularly at this time, and at any time they may become even more vital if it becomes necessary for the government to get any emergency information or warning to the American public. He said that Mr. Petrillo's action, which was not taken by the union as a whole, but by Mr. Petrillo himself, stops the government from producing numerous important recorded programs needed for the entertainment of soldiers in all parts of the world, soldiers in the field. He said it cripples all sorts of government radio ventures. And worst of all, he said, it will make it impossible for many regular radio stations of the nation to continue operations at all. He explained that a substantial proportion of American radio stations must have a continuous supply of phonograph records to keep their time filled. They cannot afford to hire actual union orchestras to provide that music alive, as we say in radio. And in some 150 towns, there are no union musicians to hire, even if they could afford to do so. Mr. Petrillo's union does not even operate there. And yet, in order to force them, those stations in those 150 towns, to hire musicians who do not exist and who are not present or available, Mr. Petrillo says that the station cannot use records because he would not allow his union musicians to make the records. If the recording companies attempt to hire non-union musicians and radio stations use those, they subject themselves to a strike on of other unions which operate the radio stations, so that's no solution. As a matter of fact, it probably would be next to impossible to get non-union musicians in New York City, where most of the recording is done, even if anyone wanted to use them. As you may know, the Department of Justice has filed a civil suit against Mr. Petrillo, attempting to stop him from carrying through this order, but it happens that the chief counsel of the American Federation of Labor Mr. Padway is out of the United States at the time. It'll be some weeks before he gets back. Therefore, the court has postponed any hearings on that civil action. Tomorrow, the head of the Federal Communications Commission, Mr. James Fly, will appear before the committee. He'll present the results of a questionnaire sent by his office to all licensed radio stations in America as to how Mr. Petrillo's order will affect them. And all answers to that questionnaire were required to be under oath, so they should be authentic. The anti-inflation legislation, which the president asked Congress to pass for him before October 1st, the legislation to stop wage increases and to put a ceiling over farm prices, is about ready for official action in the Senate tonight. The Senate Banking and Currency Committee, which has been considering that legislation, approved it informally late this afternoon, and it probably will approve it officially and formally tomorrow or Saturday. Very briefly, in the form in which they gave it their okay this afternoon, it provides that wages are to be frozen at the levels of August the 15th. There's still some agitation to make the date September the 15th, and that may be done tomorrow. But it does include a provision whereby adjustments may be made according to the formula which the War Labor Board has laid down, that formula providing for a 15% wage increase, provided the individual has not received such a 15% wage increase since January the 1st, 1941. Meanwhile, the president turned thumbs down on the sliding scale ceiling on farm prices as proposed in the House of Representatives' version of this anti-inflation bill. That, you remember, was the plan by which the cost of farm labor would be taken into consideration in deciding what the ceiling prices ought to be on farm commodities. The president sent letters to every leader of Congress today opposing that. He said that it will allow prices to continue to rise, so that angle seems to be dead. That's the top of the news as it looks from here, ladies and gentlemen. Until tomorrow evening, good night.